This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Welcome. You'll note the new intro. I like it. I like the music in particular because I wrote and arranged it. Something I did many, many years ago, finally making some good use of it. You may remember we used to use that for exit music several years ago, and then I got sick of listening to it. So it's back on. New music and new time. Hope you found us here. We're now at a permanent home Saturday, permanent as much as anything in media is permanent on Saturday. If you found us, if it's 3 o'clock Saturday, you're here. The show reruns on Sunday at 9 to 10, which is a spot we've been at for many years. So you found us. If you haven't, well, then this was futile anyway. We're going to talk about political data. Now, here's the gist of what we're going to do this time. Every year we have elections. To some extent, the results depend on who the candidates are, how they perform, party registration, and issues of the moment. These are hard to predict in advance. There are, however, larger forces which define the environment, and these are known. They evolve often slowly and often so slowly that it's hardly noticeable, the changes. These can include demographics and party identification. We've assembled here today a crack team of data nerds, and I include myself among them, to discuss the latter. So we're not going to talk so much about today's headlines, but long-term changes in the Arizona political landscape that define what the state is and what it's likely to become. Three guests. Tony Sissons is the owner and president of Research Advisory Services in Phoenix. He's a geodemographer specializing in expert opinion and population growth, socioeconomic characters, political redistricting, and voting rights data analysis. We'll talk to him later primarily about redistricting issues. Paul Bentz is Senior Vice President for Research and Strategy for Arizona High Ground, which means he is their numbers guy. And Garrett Archer is a political reporter for KNXV Channel 15 in Phoenix. He was previously Senior Analyst and Chief Data Guru for the Arizona Secretary of State. In that role, he acquired a cult-like following on Twitter as the Arizona Data Guru. I know I was part of the cult. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
First big question. I looked at the overall pattern of voter registration trends in Arizona over the last decade or two. And what I see in big picture is the following. The Republicans have maintained an advantage over the Democrats of a relatively constant amount. I think it's 3 or 4%. The number of independents, however, is skyrocketing. It has surpassed the number of Democrats. So first there are slightly more Republicans than independents, and then there are more independents than Democrats. But usually in terms of predicting whether the state leans blue or red, it's the difference between Republicans and Democrats. So the Republicans have a more or less constant lead over the Democrats. Yet you look over the last several elections, and it looks like the state is no longer safely Republican, but is increasingly competitive or purple. That says to me that the independents may lean Democrat. Paul?
I think that's the case. But one thing fundamentally to bear in mind is that Arizona is still a red state. It is trending towards competitive. I definitely think it will be competitive in 2020. But you look at 2018, you look no further than the state mine inspector, the Republican.
I've always cited that in here as the one to watch. Tell us what.
That's the bellwether. Yes. The state mine inspector, the Republican, with very little attention paid to that race, won with 52% of the vote. So yeah. I think the general electorate still tends to lean Republican. Now, that being said, 2018 is still a Republican-heavy election. So that does shift as we go towards 2020. One little dirty secret, though, is we talk a lot about the blue wave. And the assumption is that Democrats are way over-registering compared to everybody else. But Republicans, as you said, Mike, are actually keeping up. And actually, through October of last year, actually outstripped Democrats when it comes to registration. Now we'll see when the numbers come out.
By how many?
They by about 3,000 extra votes. Republicans gained about 58,000. Democrats gained about 55,000 since the last election. But we'll see what the next
that's
numbers
kind,
come
That's
back.
Kind of rounding here. It's definitely not a Democratic gain, though.
Kept up, though. Yeah. Not the blue wave that we assume that we're
not
that
in registration.
Correct.
So if not registration, is it turnout?
Well, just to make one quick point here, Mike, the last several elections, we've actually seen a drop in registration for independents. This is a trend that before 2018, 2016 did not occur, as it was always every single registration period, the independents would be usually the highest person that's being group that's being registered. Nowadays, we're seeing both Republicans and Democrats being the dominant registration. People are choosing to be independents at a lesser rate in the last 3 or 4 years than they were previously.
That's pre-Trump as well.
Yes,
as
that is pre-Trump. And on top of that, this question is also a split between the what we've seen nationally, which is the rural and the urban splits in elections. The Democrats, for example, even though the rural counties have not had tremendous growth, Democrats have seen a drop off in registration in many rural counties. For example, in the last 10 years, Mojave County has a 50% less Democrats in that state registered than they were in 2009. So we see consolidation of urban Democratic growth and loss in the rural counties, and Republicans gaining in the rural counties and gaining at a slower rate than the Democrats in the urban counties.
And that's one of the reasons why. That's probably the biggest thing in our politics is urban-rural. You look at one of those maps of red and blue, where blues are Democrat and reds are Republicans by county, and you look at the map of the whole country, and it's this massive swath of red with these little kind of blue islands, and those islands are urban centers.
Right.
Urban and suburban centers. And the massive land area in this country is Republican. But low density areas.
Arizona is a microcosm of the country in that way, in that you see, if you think of the rural areas, either the more suburban areas, you look at sort of the outskirts of the valley, for example, those are gaining more conservative votes. And you can look at like the school bond elections from 2019 to help prove that, where you see in the outside areas and the
You're
more
talking
rural
about
areas.
What area, for example?
Cape the Northwest Creek? Valley. If you look at like Northwest Valley Surprise mm-hmm. and further up there, and you look out in Pinal County and in Casa Grande and some of those areas, Pinal County had a 42% passage rate of bonds compared to Maricopa County, which was a 77% passage rate. So you can look at things like that. Arizona is a microcosm. You see, as Garrett mentioned, more Democrats coming into more of the urban center, more of the Republicans concentrating in sort of the outskirts and in the rural areas. So in a lot of ways, we reflect the country and, you know, the flyover states versus the urban centers.
Now, when you talk about Pinal County, I assume there's a big break between Maricopa, which I would think the town of Maricopa, which I would think would behave more like Metro Phoenix, and the remainder of the county, which is pretty rural. Is that fair?
No, I would say that Pinal is sort of in a transition state right now. It's going from becoming an agricultural county to more of a suburban feeder county to Maricopa. And a lot of the growth in Pinal has been concentrated in the Santan Valley region. But Maricopa town does behave more like, say, Gilbert than
It's an outer suburb
at this point of Maricopa County.
Well, I can't wait to hear from Tony later, but one thing, he put together these great charts that we all got to look at before, and you watch the Republican surge in Pinal County, and it's very readily apparent that the folks that are moving basically from the East Valley to more affordable homes or in the Southeast Valley, you look at Santan Valley, you look at Queen Creek, you look at Maricopa, even Casa Grande, which is growing at a pretty decent size clip. Those are becoming more suburban or feeder county, as Garrett mentioned, and that's definitely changing. And so you look at that.
And what are their politics?
The more conservative. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see that that's reflected in things like only 42% of their bonds and overrides.
So passing. we need to distinguish inner versus outer suburbs.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay, we'll pick this up. We'll return in the think tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
All right, we are back discussing political data trends, long-term trends, with a group of data nerds, including myself. Want to ask the question, one thing that seems to have changed most in the general political layout of the state is the following. Arizona's traditionally been a very Republican state, and that's because Maricopa County has been very Republican, and they are 60-some-odd percent of the state, which has to cannot be overcome by a 20% rural, 20% Pima County. Increasingly, Maricopa County looks like it's dead even split, and that provides an opportunity for Democrats who are still very solid in Pima. And Pima is slightly bigger than the rural areas, and that's kind of the lay of the land for something approaching a toss-up state, maybe still lean a little red. But, Garrett, what's your take on that analysis? What's the future for – what do you see in Maricopa County?
So, yeah, just like you just said, the general consensus among political operatives in the state for several years now has been Maricopa County is where the action is because Pima and the rural counties sort of cancel each other out. So in the last several elections, especially 2018, we saw a situation in which the Democratic electorate in Maricopa County was extremely energized and put Kyrsten Sinema over McSally in Maricopa of 672,000 Kyrsten Sinema had 732,000 votes to Martha McSally's only 672,000. So we're talking about pretty large numbers in Maricopa County. And what's interesting about that, of course, is that Doug Ducey also won Maricopa County. So what we're seeing is what we talked about in the last segment is we're seeing a divergence in the inner suburbs of Maricopa County, in which this is an area that is surrounding the Loop 101. It's the precincts that go from truly from the start of the 101 on Glendale, following all the way down to Chandler-Ahwatukee. These precincts that sort of hug the 101 freeway are areas in which we've seen a lot of diversifying growth. The demographic change in these areas has been a little bit more stark than some of the other areas of the county, and that has contributed to this sort of swinginess of Maricopa County in this last election, and in fact, indeed, in 2016 as well. Trump won Maricopa County, but he barely won Maricopa County. So, you know, what's going to happen in 2020? You know, that's what everyone's going to be obviously on everybody's mind. You know, is Trump going to be able to carry Maricopa County? Because in reality, a Republican candidate can afford to probably lose Maricopa County by about 2 points. If they lose Maricopa by more than 2 points, then their chances of having that made up in the rural counties starts to dim very quickly.
Say the Republican can lose Maricopa by 2 points.
They can. Because
Pima is a little bit larger than the rural areas are coming out big Republican.
Yes.
Pima County is going the other way.
Right. Yes, but Pima County is not. It's been pretty stable over the last several elections as far as it's the amount of votes it's delivered to Democrats. But rural counties have delivered consistently more votes for Republicans, and so a Republican statewide again has about a 2 point buffer. I mean, of course, this is all napkin math, but they have about a 2 point buffer before things get very dire statewide.
It used to be so for a Republican to win in the state of Arizona, they run up the score in rural, they stay competitive or lose less in Pima, and then run up the score in the traditionally red Maricopa County. The Democrats' methodology, if you look at Napolitano back in 2006, for example, or 2002, what she had to do is run up the score in Pima, try to hold off in rural, and then be competitive in Maricopa. And Napolitano won Maricopa by doing very well in the East Valley all those years ago. And so that was sort of the strategy. You look at Sinema and what she did in this last cycle. She ran up the score big time in Maricopa. It's a different strategy for Democrats than we saw a
couple
of years ago.
Because the base has shifted underneath them. It was a bigger accomplishment for Napolitano over the base assumption.
Correct. And right? The other thing is one of the things that Garrett talked about, you look at the 101, you look at these high wage jobs, these higher educated professionals. Those are the folks that are moving in closer to the 101, and those are sort of the higher income areas as well. You look at folks like Intel and those people who are moving to these areas. They're shifting the demographics. You look at Ahwatukee, for example, the demographics and the way their voting patterns have shifted over the last couple of years, and it's starting to move over towards Chandler and Gilbert as well because of that same reason.
Yeah, I mean, Ahwatukee used to be a fairly reliable Republican cluster in the county, and that has dissipated very rapidly.
10 years ago, Ahwatukee is represented by three Republicans. 10 years later, it's represented by three Democrats.
Yeah, that's a major, major change. And one of the interesting things about that I've noticed, it's so curious to me, you look at voting propensity by income, and it's still true that higher income people tend to vote Republican. But it's true that higher educated people tend to vote Democrat, which is extraordinary given the high correlation between income and education. It says, wow, there's something very, very peculiar going on there with those two factors simultaneously.
They definitely fight against one another, yeah. I think part of the thing that helps Republicans is lower income individuals tend to vote more Republican as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to that point, where that dichotomy really plays out, interestingly, is those inner areas of Maricopa County. So people who have a higher education and maybe even a higher income, as Paul said, you know, they're choosing to live in condos in areas with more modern sort of amenities, whereas people in the East Valley have incomes that are fairly equal, if not a little higher, than those areas in Chandler. However, they do not have that same. They don't take that same choice. They decide to move out there, and those people, for some reason, are more conservative.
And we do cluster. We cluster,
yes,
attitudinally to an extraordinary degree. And as you point out, even among,
yes,
people of similar incomes, there tends to be some attitude. There's something going on that's attitudinal, having to do with people finding a comfort zone where they want to live. We will be back, and we will talk to Tony Sessions when we come back about the whole reapportionment process. Arizona's potentially in for a 10th congressional seat, and what happens with that and related issues when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The morning lights, the streets that lead them, and sirens call them on.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back. We are discussing all things data, long-term data trends. One of the most significant things that's going to happen in this state and in the rest of the country is that after the 2020 census, which will occur in April, there will be a reapportionment effort, and Arizona seems to be poised to pick up another congressional seat. Tony, your analysis, however, is a little less certain about that than most. Your take, first of all, do we get a 10th seat, and then we'll talk about what happens.
Yes. There's no specific population figure that will guarantee Arizona's 10th seat. Each state's eligibility to gain or lose a district is completely dependent on a formula that Congress has used since 1941 to prioritize the allocation of 435 available congressional seats. How Arizona fares under that formula depends on that formula's simultaneous pushing and pulling of populations in the other 49 states. Every December, whenever the Census Bureau publishes state population estimates, I run those estimates through Congress's formula and plot a year-by-year trend line for each state's new seat to gain or lose. In 2018, Arizona's 10th seat trend line dropped for the first time into the eligibility range. It had an eligibility priority value of 432, or 3 points below the...
In other words, there's 435 seats.
Right.
If that 10th seat is number 432, we get a seat. If it drops to 435, we get a seat. If it drops to 436, we don't.
Right.
In other words, we're at the edge.
We are. And unfortunately, towards the end of the decade, that trend line is flattening out, so that if Arizona wants a 10th seat, households must respond to the 2020 census.
And I think of the relevance of that when we had all this discussion about putting a citizenship question on the census, which,
yes,
I think all demographers agreed would have the effect of suppressing Hispanic participation in the census. And given that that is a disproportionate number of Arizonans, that would probably have cost us a seat.
Yes,
and still, right, may, if there, because we, the level of trust in participation participation in the census is mandatory, but if people are reticent, they don't participate. And if Hispanics are disproportionately prone not to participate, it probably cost us a seat. I think that's the bottom line analysis. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is very fair.
Okay, so talk to us about the process. Say, we either do or don't get a seat. It looks now like, well, probably yes, but certainly not for sure. Talk to us about the reapportionment process.
Well, I got
to make drawing the lines, basically.
Right. Well, actually, reapportionment isn't the drawing the lines. That's redistricting.
Excuse me. So, thank you. I stand corrected. I want to ask about redistricting.
Okay. Reapportionment, of course, one interesting thing about it is that the formula that Congress uses to allocate congressional seats to states, the formula has a priority multiplier built into it that diminishes as the seat number increases. And for instance, California has the most seats in Congress, but the priority multiplier for California's existing 53rd district is so small that even when it's applied to the state's almost 40 million population, the formula results in California's possible loss of its 53rd districts. So actually, the more seats a state has, the more difficult it is to gain the next seat and the easier it is to lose one.
And California's been gaining a seat in every census, and this is, I think, the first census at which California's at risk for possibly losing a seat.
Right, yeah. Now, redistricting, on the other hand, is drawing the lines on the map. And that's a process that Arizona has been using for two decades now, an independent redistricting commission. And that commission has certain districting principles that it has to follow. And I can quickly go over those.
Yeah, please.
The first one is, of course, equal population. In drawing the congressional map, there is no variance in district size allowed. Each district has to be equal right down to the person. For legislative map, up to about a 10% variance is permissible. The second factor they have to pay attention to is compliance with the Voting Rights Act. The newly drawn districts have to have neither the purpose nor the effect of diminishing minority populations' abilities to elect candidates of their choice. Excuse me.
In practicality, that means do not dilute the minority voting strength in already Hispanic districts in Arizona.
Yeah, that is true, yes.
Which has the incidental effect of helping Republicans because it tends to concentrate Democrats heavily.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Districts, of course, have to be compact and contiguous. Contiguous means that there shouldn't be any islands or satellites to a district. It should be possible to go to every part of a district without having to leave the district. Another factor, respect communities of interest. Communities that have similar attitudes about public policy issues should not be split into separate districts so as to dilute their voting strength. One of the other factors is the district should use visible geographic features or city or town boundaries or undivided census tracts.
Mountains, rivers,
yes.
Political boundaries.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the other factor that comes into play quite a bit in the discussion of all of this is the matter of favoring competitive districts. The commission should strive for political party balance in the districts.
Now, that, unfortunately, that's last on the list, isn't it, in priority as well as in your order?
Well, it is the last matter listed in the Constitution. And commissions in the past, the attorneys for the commissions have convinced commissioners that its last placement means least placement.
Mm-hmm. So, but whether or not it is, that's not necessarily legally determinative. That's a matter of judgment, is it?
The state Supreme Court has chimed in on this matter and is of the opinion that that competitiveness is a factor that needs to be considered right from the very beginning of the process. Certainly, the first commission paid attention to all of the rules that I've mentioned earlier, and then decided, well, we can't really do much about favoring competitive districts because that'll undo the other work that
when
we
I
have
went
done.
As you were going through that list, I'm going through that and saying that all sounds fine and good, but you can't do all of those things simultaneously.
Thank you.
You can only do more of one by doing less of another.
These principles tend to get in each other's way.
And,
yes.
And I wanted to scream, too, when I heard that and say, listen, if you want good government, its competitiveness is the one that matters. Because otherwise, you know the result before you even vote.
Right. On the matter of competitiveness, this is something I've been saying for the last almost 20 years. In Arizona, it is easier to draw competitive districts than it is to avoid doing so. And in my opinion, both commissions have avoided drawing as many competitive districts as they could have. Both political parties, of course, want districts that are favorably safe for their candidates. And four of the five commissioners are appointed by political party leaderships.
Now, the political party leadership appoints, but aren't they working off of a pre-screened list that is from the appellate court commission?
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
And how far has that process begun at this point?
No, it has not.
It has not. Because this one of the points of that is that the initial list gets drafted by this commission, and that commission is 100% appointed by our current Republican governor.
Very true.
So
right now. Yeah.
Depends on what kind of list they come up with. I mean, in other words, a Democratic leader gets to pick, in the House, gets to pick one. If they have a decent pool to pull from, that's not an issue. If the pool's been stacked, then you may have a partisan commission.
Right. If the pool has been if the commission on the appellate court appointments decides to favor weak Democrats,
favor Democrats in name only.
Well,
you know, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there's, are
true.
They, I mean,
right.
there are rules you cannot have been involved in partisan politics at any level. Can't been a precinct committee or something. But this has been known 10 years in advance. I suspect there's more than enough folks out there who would be very, who would meet those criteria, yet would not be what they purport to be.
The usual argument that I hear about lack of competitive districts is that by the time you draw the required number of voting districts or voting rights districts, that uses up so many Democrats that there are not enough left over to make many competitive districts. The other half of the story is never mentioned. And here I'm talking about legislative districts. There are large swaths of heavily Republican residential areas, Scottsdale, East Valley, Tucson Foothills, that cover 7 to 8 districts worth of territory that cannot be made competitive because everywhere you look along the edges of those districts, you find more Republicans. So take the 9 or 10 largely Democratic voting rights districts and the 7 or 8 highly Republican districts off the map. And you have 12 to 14 districts worth of territory that have about the same partisan mix as the entire state. And in that remaining territory, at least 10 districts can be competitively balanced.
So, in other words, and we have to conclude we're running out of time in this segment, we currently have 3 or 4, I think most people agree, 3 or 4 competitive districts. You say that number could be 10.
Yes.
And still comply with voting rights law.
Legislative, yes.
In other words, 10 districts where the voters would actually get to make a choice.
Yes.
If you were so motivated to do that.
Right.
That We'll pick up other matters. And thank you, Tony. We'll be back in the think tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back discussing long-term political trends in the state of Arizona. One of the biggies that we have yet to discuss, and it is very much has been on the agenda for years, which is Hispanic voting trends. The Hispanic voter has been oft promised and never delivered in this state. Paul, is that changing? Are we seeing anything going on with Hispanic voter participation? It's about 30% of the state, but a much smaller percent of voter participation.
That's correct. Typically, it is about 30% of the state's population. It's usually somewhere between 14% and 16% of the voter participation. I believe Garrett will probably correct me if I'm wrong there. But like younger voters, I think it's a large base of individuals that don't all think necessarily alike, but that have a lot of potential there. I've seen folks think that it's going to be in the high 20% range. That there's going to be a significant amount of participation this
high
time around.
20 compared to 15 compared would be to 15, huge.
It'd be a massive uptick. It still would be underperforming, like younger voters compared to what we've seen in other areas. But I do think that the trend goes in that way. I do think that what we're seeing is also a massive uptick in progressive voters as well. You can actually see that as indicated by the number of competitive Democratic primaries we're going to see in 2020. We've seen – used to be that Democrats struggled in Arizona to even field a full set of candidates in, say, legislative races and other. Now we're actually seeing competitive races. In fact, a little bit – Democrats are experiencing a little bit of the Tea Party of the left. I think that they're actually targeting some of their own and going after folks they don't think are progressive enough, which shows the shifts in demographics not only in
Is this occurring in safe Democratic seats?
Yes, or incredibly so.
And that's where it's safe to do that.
Right. Well, and it's starting to shift that way, though. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's something 10 years ago we saw in Republican districts with the Tea Party. I think we're going to see more of that. And I do think that is where the Hispanic vote plays a huge role, because some of those are those districts that Tony mentioned earlier. And I think it's more competitive overall as more people are activated and engaged, that will be a bigger trend in the future.
Yes. So Hispanic voters have gained. They are trending upwards when compared to white non-Hispanic voters, especially in 2018.
At what kind of a rate? We're talking about
So usually it's about as Paul was saying, Hispanic voters absolutely do punch below their weight demographically in the state. They make up about 30% or so of the state, and they only vote at about anywhere from 15% to 18% of the electorate is Hispanic. But in this last 2018 election, that did start to – it's starting to crest to 20%. I would not be surprised if it goes to 20% in 2020. And one of the interesting aspects of that is that if you look at the trends in the Hispanic voting population, the vast majority or large plurality, pardon me, of voters are of the age of 18 to 34, which is very interesting because voting is intrinsically a behavior. And as those people, these younger people, which is the largest Hispanic voting transitions to being 35 and going into age ranges that in the other demographics have a higher rate of voting than the younger ones, then what's interesting is those 18 to 34 voters will probably be replaced by another set of 18 to 34-year-old Hispanics that will vote. So I presume that we're going to see a fairly large explosion of that Hispanic voting population that certain political groups have been asking for several years now. I think we're on the crest of that. That could actually occur.
Two interesting observations. One is the aging of the Hispanic population would – as you suggest, would put more Hispanics into an age group which is typically typified by higher voting levels.
Yes.
So some of the underperformance has been age masked by ethnicity.
Yes.
But you also said something that intrigued me, that you think that the younger Hispanic population is prone to vote more than the population they're replacing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the chart I'm looking at right now, 18 to 34-year-old Hispanics made up more than 80,000 voters in 2018. And the next population, 35 to 44-year-olds, only made up 50,000. And let's go to a higher trend, 55 to 60, 64, which is in white alone, non-Hispanic is the highest rate of voting for white non-Hispanics. That group only voted at 50-ish thousand percent. So that 80,000 is the largest voting group of Hispanics. And they're soon to transition to a group that even more of them will start voting. Because 35-year-olds and higher, that's when voting really begins.
I think one other thing to observe is that there are groups doing a spectacular job activating and engaging younger voters, younger Hispanic voters. You look at Mi Familia Vota Lucha, La Machine, and many others that I'm probably not naming right now that are all doing a very good job of activating and engaging voters. They spent most of 2019. You see higher voter turnout in off-cycle elections than we've seen in many years. You look at the Phoenix mayor's race. You look at the Prop 105-106 transit election, which was one of the highest off-cycle turnouts in Phoenix history. You look at some of these school elections where we saw turnout as high as 50% higher than usual. Organizations are out there getting these voters in the habit of voting so that they will be ready to vote 2020 and beyond. And I think that habit is sinking in and is taking place. And I think, as Garrett mentioned, it's going to reap long-term rewards for them.
Yeah, voting is a matter of habit. And if that occurs, then it's a long-term trend that has to factor into our politics. And given that Hispanics are about 2-to-1 demographic, Democratic rather, that portends well for evolving in a Democratic direction in the state. We've got just a couple minutes left. I want to a real quick answer. What do you think happens to the composition of the Arizona Congressional District and Congressional Delegation of this time, based on long-term trends, do you see anything that's pushing a trend in one?
I don't see anything changing in this next election.
I don't see anything changing either. I don't think Schweikert's vulnerable to a Democrat. I think he might be vulnerable to a Republican challenger, but no one's emerged, so I don't see any change here.
But interesting, status quo now in this supposedly Republican state is 5-4 Democratic. So
correct.
Maybe at a high point.
I think we see a world, though, real quick, that Donald Trump wins the state of Arizona and Mark Kelly is our next U.S. senator.
Yeah, well, that's indicative of another argument that we're a swing state if that turns out to be the case.
Paul wouldn't take that bet.
Okay, thank you very much, Garrett Archer, Paul Benz, and Tony Sessions. We'll see you next week in the think tank. Remember the new time. Saturday at 3 and Sunday at 9 p.m. We continue. We'll see you next week.
And sirens call them on.